Are we currently living in a virtual reality? How could we ever know? Could such a world be real, and can a life in it be good? Welcome to another English episode of Philosophisk Podcast. So my name is Ola Risberg, and I'm hosting today with Nils Sylvan.
And our guests are David Chalmers, professor of philosophy at New York University, and Anande Hatiangadi, professor of philosophy at Stockholm University. And we are here to talk about David's new book, Reality Plus. First of all, welcome, both of you, to the podcast.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
And I want to start by asking you, David, to just give a brief summary of the main thesis of your book and perhaps start telling us why you decided to write the book in the first place.
The book is a philosophical examination of issues about reality, especially through the lens of virtual reality and virtual worlds. I guess I got started on this topic. I mean, issues about reality are everywhere in philosophy. Descartes asked, how can we know anything about the external world? How can you know that an evil demon isn't fooling you into believing that all of this is real when none of it's real? These days, we often phrase those questions by saying, how do we know we're not living in a giant computer simulation? Or maybe even, how do we know we're not living in the Matrix? For me, actually, I got drawn to think about some of these issues when, way back around the time the Matrix movies came out, I got invited to write a piece for the website of the movie. It turned out the Wachowskis are actually quite interested in philosophy, and they commissioned a bunch of philosophers to talk about issues in the movie. And I'd been independently starting to think about the old philosophical experiment of the brain in a vat. What should we say about a brain sitting bubbling in a lab, getting its inputs from a giant computer simulation? And then The Matrix just illustrates that so beautifully. At the beginning, it seems like you're in an external, a normal reality, and it turns out to be a giant computer simulation. Well, this is a kind of a device for raising many of the great issues in philosophy. How can we know anything about the external world? What is it to be real? What's the nature of reality? What's the connection between mind and body? And what is it to live a good or meaningful life? So, yeah, about 20 years ago, I wrote something on those themes in an article called The Matrix as Metaphysics. But over time, I guess, these themes just got, I started thinking more and more about them. And eventually, it came to seem to me that, this is a device for thinking about many of the great problems of philosophy. So I decided to write a book which was simultaneously an introduction to philosophy and many of its problems, and an analysis of some of these problems about the nature of reality. And, the central thesis of the book is that virtual reality is genuine reality. There's a long tradition of thinking that virtual realities have to be fake or fictional realities. There are second-class realities and not genuinely real. I think that actually virtual realities are in many ways on a par with physical reality. They're not exactly the same, but they're certainly just as real. So one of the theses of the book is that virtual realities, virtual worlds, virtual objects are just as real as physical objects, physical worlds, and so on. And epistemologically, I argue that we can't know that we're not ourselves in a virtual world. We could be in a world like the Matrix, and there'd be nothing to rule that out. Descartes uses that to argue that we can't know anything about reality, because if we're in the Matrix, nothing is real. But that's where I think Descartes goes wrong there. I want to say that even if we're in the Matrix, everything is real. So ultimately, I want to use this claim that virtual reality is genuine reality to undercut some of those traditional moves made by Descartes in his epistemology. So there's the epistemology, we can't know, we're not in a virtual world. There's the metaphysics, virtual worlds are real and the objects in them are real. And there's also a thesis about value, that we can in fact lead a meaningful life in virtual reality. So those are the three central theses of the book as I think about it.
So Anand, as the philosopher of sort of language and thought, and you know, this touches on a lot of relevant themes for you, right? Were there anything in the book that sort of struck you as especially interesting or intriguing?
I think it's hard really to pull out any a small number of things that are particularly interesting or appealing, because there's so much. It's such a rich book that covers so much ground. And though Dave has a thesis that he's defending that virtual worlds are real, they're just as real as the physical world, and this has implications for certain longstanding philosophical problems like skepticism and questions about what matters. One of the things that's great about the book is that there's a zillion other hypotheses that are also explored. So all sort, you know, it's a very wide-ranging, open-minded exploration of, you know, some of the most fundamental problems of philosophy. And so it's the kind of book that just makes you think. There might be something that Dave doesn't really defend, but he finds plausible that you might find more plausible than the view that he actually defends. And I think it encourages you to form your own opinions about some of these topics. So I guess that's maybe the big takeaway.
Right.
That's what's great about the book.
So let's pick one of the topics, the epistemological thesis that you defend, and that's that we can't know that we're not in this giant simulation. So that's the claim. Why do you claim that? What's the argument for making that claim?
Basic way of getting there is not unlike the way that many Cartesian philosophers have argued over the years. And the rough idea is that someone who was in a simulation like the Matrix could in principle have experiences of the world which are exactly the same or totally indistinguishable from those of a person in physical reality. I mean, we already have virtual reality devices that you can go into and that conjure up a three-dimensional world that you're immediately immersed in and experiencing and so on. Now, right now, the experiences you'll have inside a virtual reality headset are not indistinguishable from physical reality. You know, they're fairly primitive in some ways. They're often cartoonish. They have vision and sound, but not like taste and smell and touch. But it's easy to imagine that within a few decades, we'll have virtual realities which are much more convincing, at least visually and auditorily, and eventually give you the full experience of being in a physical world, roughly as in the movie The Matrix, where there's no way to tell from the inside that that you're in a simulation. If they're indistinguishable, then, well, you know, obviously by definition, it's hard to, you couldn't distinguish that you're there. And maybe if the experiences are the same, then it's hard to see how you could ever tell from the inside that it's different. I mean, people might say, "Hey, well, come on, things couldn't be the same inside virtual reality. Look at all these wonderful people. Look at my wonderful cat. Look at these beautiful forests. And that, how could all that be simulated?" But in principle, if the physical world, it looks like everything about our physical world is in principle something we can simulate. If so, I think you can at least make the case that there's no way to tell from the inside that you're not in a simulation, that a simulation could be exactly the same. You know, the philosopher Nick Bostrom has actually argued that, the Swedish philosopher Nick Bostrom, I should say, has argued that that in fact it may be, there may be grounds to take very seriously the idea that we're in a computer simulation, because there may actually be many computer simulations constructed over the course of the cosmos, and maybe more simulated worlds, more simulated people than non-simulated people. That line of reasoning can lead one to say this is actually a hypothesis we should take very seriously. I mean, it's not just a science fiction anymore. It's suggested by current technology in some ways that this scenario could happen. B, there's reasons to think this scenario could actually be ubiquitous. So I think in light of those things, it's I think there's a pretty strong case that you can't know you're in a virtual right. world.
So how do those two things interact for you? I mean, there is this kind of thought that you couldn't tell on the basis of your experiences whether you were in the sort of simulated world or the non-simulated one. And there's also this thought that, well, given what we know now, we can expect there to be very many simulations shortly. Are both those two sort of central in your argument here?
Yeah, I think the most central thing is that, yeah, the experiences would be the same, so we couldn't tell. And for many people, that's enough
right.
to make a Cartesian argument. But I think there's also a tradition in philosophy of people resisting that argument because the possibilities which are invoked are extremely nebulous science fiction possibilities that we don't have reason to take seriously. You can have knowledge, just requires ruling out nearby alternative versions of the world. It doesn't require ruling out every last science fiction hypothesis. So at that point, I think it becomes relevant. Maybe in Descartes' time, some of this stuff was science fiction, but these days, the technology is actually approaching. We're going to be in a position before too long to actually put people in these indistinguishable virtual realities. That makes it a hypothesis which is closer to home. I think the Bostrom point that we should expect many of these simulations to exist also makes it more of a live possibility. I mean, for me, maybe I would have been convinced of the argument just from the first point.
Right.
But I think these two other points
right.
can help prosecute the case against other philosophers who think that, we want some reason to think these possibilities are genuinely live possibilities.
Mm. So, Anand, are you on board with the line of reasoning here? Or are there certain points at which you want to push back?
Well, I guess I'm kind of on board with the line of reasoning, given the kind of starting assumption that we're imagining a simulation that is perfect in the sense that it's evidentially indistinguishable from a non-simulated world. And if you take the view that in order to know something about the external world, or in order to know that you're not living in a simulation, you'd have to be able to rule out the possibility on the basis of your evidence, it seems, I won't push back at this point on the claim that given those background assumptions, you can't know that you're not living in a simulated world.
Okay.
Yeah.
And with
the next stage,
do you want to say something about that?
Well,
next stage,
so the next stage of Dave's argument, which is where I want to push back, is on the claim that you can answer the skeptic by arguing that what you, if you were living in a virtual world or in a simulated world, then many of your beliefs would be true.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you want to present that part of the argument. That hasn't come up yet.
Yeah, could you?
Yeah.
Sure, yeah. So there's a very standard way of thinking about the hypothesis that we're in a virtual world like the Matrix, which is if we're in a virtual world, if we're in a simulation, all this is an illusion. Nothing is real. Most of what we believe about the world, I believe that, I'm sitting here at a table, there's a microphone in front of me, I'm sitting in a room with three other people, and so on. All that would turn out to be false. All this is a giant illusion. I want to say that, in fact, that standard way of thinking about things is completely wrong.
Mm.
If we are in a matrix or a lifelong computer simulation, I'm still in a room with three other people. I still have a table in front of me and a microphone. All of this is real. If it's a computer simulation, then what I want to say is, okay, well, then we're living in a digital world. We're living in a world where the tables and the microphones and so on are ultimately made out of computer processes at some level. They're digital objects, but to be digital is not to be unreal. For me, you know, being digital is still a way of being real. So if we are in a matrix scenario, I think there's still tables, there's still microphones, there's still people, there's still trees, there's still forests. They're just digital. So I'm going to say that, the hypothesis that we're in a matrix is not a skeptical hypothesis where all of our ordinary beliefs turn out to be false. I think it's a metaphysical hypothesis, one about the nature of our reality, but one which is consistent with most of our ordinary beliefs about the world being true.
And this is where you don't agree, Ananda?
Yeah. So the point at which I disagree is where it interacts with the original skeptical argument. So the assumption that I guess was being made by the skeptic was that in order to know, for example, that there's a table in front of me, I need to be able to rule out possibilities in which that's not the case, right? There's sort of two parts of Dave's response to the skeptic, which involves my beliefs being true in the simulation. And so in order to argue for that, he argues both that things would be real, they would just be made of digital stuff. But the other side of that is that if I am living in a simulation, then my beliefs are about the virtual objects and properties that I interact with in the simulation. So when I believe that there's a table in front of me in the simulation, what I'm believing is that there's a virtual table in front of me. Now, the worry that I have about this line of argument against the skeptic is that while Dave, I think, convincingly argues that if I were in a simulation, my beliefs would be true, what he doesn't show is that the beliefs that I actually have, given that I am living in a physical world, have a content that would be true if evaluated at the simulated world. So in our world, assuming that I live in a physical world, when I believe that there's a table in front of me, my belief is about a physical table, and that belief with that content is false if we consider it or evaluate it at a simulated world.
So you believe that you think if we were in the matrix, we would actually have true beliefs about the world. We would not be deluded. But nonetheless, the possibility that we're in a matrix somehow undercuts our actual beliefs. You might have thought that as long as we can't go wrong, then our beliefs are looking okay. But you think we can't go wrong, but nonetheless, this possibility.
I think there's a subtle difference between we can't go wrong and what I believe. So I think the skeptic casts doubt on the epistemic status of the belief that I actually have. And if the belief that I actually have has this content about physical stuff, right, given that I'm interacting with physical objects, what I believe is that there's a physical table in front of me. That belief with that content would have been false if I were living in a virtual world. So if you think I need to be able to rule out the possibility in which the proposition that I believe is false, right, then I need to rule out the simulation hypothesis, because that is a possibility in which the proposition I in fact believe is false.
Interesting. So we say, just say we're in the matrix right now, and we go through all this philosophical reasoning, and you say, if we are in the matrix right now, then the belief I have is correct. It's true.
Yes. And you know what? There's a skeptic who comes along to you in the matrix. So you're in the matrix. I, the skeptic, come along and I say, how do you know that you're not living in a physical world? Because all the evidence that you have is compatible with that hypothesis. And so in the matrix, you face this kind of reverse skeptical scenario, right?
Totally.
The skeptical hypothesis is that you're living in a physical world, because in that world, the beliefs that you actually have, given that you're living in the matrix, are false.
But if we're in the matrix, we can reason, if I am in a physical world, then all the beliefs, even if I'm in a, if I am in a physical world, all my beliefs are true. So I'm just trying to see, why should I worry about this skeptical hypothesis if I know that if I'm in the matrix, my belief is fine?
So I think it might go back to this, the first point where I wasn't pushing back, and I wasn't pushing back against the background of this assumption that in order to know something, I need to be able to rule out all alternatives in which what I believe is false, right? So strictly speaking, the possibility in which I'm living in the matrix, given that I'm living in a physical world, is one in which what I believe is false. And so if to know that P, I need to be able to rule out that possibility in which not P, then I don't know that there's a table in front of me because I can't rule out the skeptical simulation hypothesis. But what you just said in response was, but you know, your beliefs would be fine, right? But that I think relies on a different kind of principle about what is required for knowledge, something a little bit more, as they call it, epistemic externalist, right? That my belief would be safe because if I were living in a simulation, then I wouldn't believe the thing that I actually believe.
Mm. In the book, I make an analogy between, the physical world and the virtual world. And the philosopher's thought experiment of like Earth and Twin Earth.
Earth,
where the watery stuff is made of H2O, and Twin Earth, where it's made of XYZ. And I try to argue, at the beginning, I don't know whether I'm in the Earth world or the Twin Earth world, but either way, my belief that water is in the, if I'm on Earth, my belief that there's water in the cup comes out true. And if I'm on Twin Earth, it also comes out true. So there's no skeptical worry about whether there's really water in the cup coming from the fact that there's an XYZ twin earth possibility. But now if I understand you correctly, I got to worry about whether there's really water in that cup because there's a possible world where there's at least an epistemic possibility where the watery stuff is made of XYZ. And in that possibility, the content of my actual belief could come out false. So should I be worried about whether there's water in the cup based on the twin earth possibility?
I wasn't thinking that you would have to. I mean, this gets into some slightly more technical issues to do with the nature of content. But so if we think that there is a content that is shared between the virtual world and our world, so the physical world and the simulated world, or between the watery world, the H2O world and the XYZ world, that content is true in both cases.
Mm-hmm.
Your response to the skeptic relies on the content being different in the two cases, right? So in the simulated world, the content of my belief is these, virtual objects that I interact with. That's what my belief is about in that world. And so that's why I think there's it's central to your argument that the contents are different in those cases. And then answering the skeptic is reliant in part on this claim about the content being different in those
Interesting.
Cases.
Yeah, I don't think actually of that claim as being crucial. My own view is that in fact there is a content which is shared by the person on Earth and the person on Twin Earth, what philosophers call a narrow content that corresponds to how things are internally, where both of them are roughly thinking that, there's this watery stuff out there.
Yeah.
And I actually want to argue there's a content shared between the person on Earth, a person in a physical world, and a person in a virtual world. And that can be used. And this is actually what I think of as the epistemic or epistemologically relevant content in these cases, the one that's relevant to skepticism. The point where the differences in content come in, I think of as actually the argument in the book that virtual worlds are real doesn't go through any of these issues about content at all. That comes in much later in the book when I address a certain kind of objection, which is roughly the objection that, as I put it in the book, virtual hurricanes don't make you wet. Hey, I can look at someone over there in a virtual world and hey, there are no hurricanes there. There's just something else there. And at that point, I think it becomes relevant to distinguish different kinds of content. But yeah.
Yeah. I guess the extent to which you motivate the response to skepticism, at least part of it relies on the idea that your beliefs are true, if you're living in a simulation. And I guess it's true that kind of the development of that claim in terms of content variance, right? The way in which content depends on the way the environment is around you. It's true that comes later in the book, but at least in light of that discussion, it seems like it's crucial to the response to the skeptic that they're different contents. And if I understand your view correctly, it's that our beliefs are associated with two contents, right? The narrow content and the wide content, which depends on mm-hmm. the way the world is in relevant respects. And so if you think that beliefs are associated with a pair of contents, you have the same kind of problem that I was alluding to in the beginning, right? Which is that the belief with that pair of contents that you actually have is going to be at least one of those contents comes out false when evaluated at this simulated world.
Ah, very interesting. Okay, I have to think about all this.
Another maybe easier response to the sort of simulation argument would be to say that, look, there are some aspects of, you know, our world or our life which you just couldn't simulate, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe consciousness is one of those. You go through this in the book, right? You know, if we're conscious, which, you know, I seem to be as far as I can tell, right? And if consciousness is something you can't simulate, we could use that kind of response, right? But you're not convinced by that, is that right?
Yeah, so that's right. I think one of the biggest sticking points for the argument, if you want to oppose it, is the status of consciousness in a simulation. Actually, I think it goes... there are different versions here of the simulation hypothesis. One version is the pure simulation, where everything is simulated, including the people and the brains and so on. And that one raises the issue of, could a person who was fully simulated be conscious? But if you're just worried about setting up this skeptical scenario, I think you can also do it the way it's done in The Matrix. In The Matrix, Neo and Trinity are not simulated
right.
beings. I mean, they might have simulated bodies, but their brains are actually there outside The Matrix in what looks to be physical space. They are real biological entities connected to a simulation. And this way, it manages to bypass the issue of whether a simulated being could be conscious, because the brain doesn't have to be simulated. It's just the rest of the world gets to be simulated. So I do think you can get the whole mm-hmm. simulation hypothesis, the whole Matrix scenario going that way. Just suppose I'm a biological being connected to a simulation. But yeah, there is, that's what I call a biosim, a biological creature connected to a simulation, or sometimes an impure simulation. But there's also a pure simulation, which involves where the brains themselves are simulated. And then that does raise the question of whether a simulated being could be conscious. My own view is that it could. My own view is there's nothing special about biology. If a biological brain can be conscious, a silicon brain could also be conscious. And if you replaced all the neurons by silicon chips, we could still be conscious. So furthermore, I think even if that's wrong, can we know that's wrong? So I think at the very least, it's a serious epistemic yeah. possibility that simulated beings could be conscious. And maybe that's all we need to get the skeptical, to get the epistemological argument going.
So why is it that after replacing the neurons with silicon chips, it is that consciousness is still there instead of having been lost along the way?
I like this thought experiment of gradually uploading your biological brain to silicon. We start by replacing one neuron by a silicon chip that functions exactly the same way, and then another neuron, 5% of the brain, 10% of the brain, 50% of the brain, until eventually you've replaced the whole brain by silicon chips, which are functioning identically, so they produce exactly the same behavior. If somebody thinks the silicon system at the end is not conscious, then we have to ask, what happens to consciousness along the way? Does it gradually fade out through like halfway conscious states? Does it suddenly disappear when you replace a certain special neuron? I want to argue those views are very implausible, and therefore we actually ought to accept the alternative, which is the consciousness stays there the whole time.
Could you say why you think it's so implausible, those other views, especially the one where consciousness sort of fades away along the way?
I guess what would happen, actually, I've got very rich consciousness now with vision and hearing and bodily senses and thought. So how are we going to think about like a halfway case where my behavior and so on is just as it is now, but my consciousness is halfway faded? It's like, well, you know, what happens here? Do I lose like hearing before vision? Have I lost some distinctions in my visual field? Maybe I'm now colorblind. I'm only experiencing black and white, even though I...
world is a bit dizzy.
Yeah. I say the whole time that I'm experiencing full color. Mm-hmm. I believe that I'm richly conscious of all these things. But in fact, my consciousness has gradually faded away. So I'm very deeply wrong about my state of consciousness. I will believe and swear up and down that I'm fully conscious when I'm not. I mean, you might say this is like the case of a zombie silicon twin of us who swears up and down they're conscious, but they're not conscious. But I don't know, the case where this actually happens to a conscious being that's so vastly wrong about the state of their own consciousness, to me, that's a little bit pathological. And I've tried to argue in the past that it's much more sensible to accept the view where we're more in touch, where conscious beings are more in touch with their phenomenology than this, and therefore consciousness is preserved throughout.
So I guess whenever I hear philosophers, you know, presenting arguments having to do with sort of small differences, I get sort of a little bit worried about vagueness and sorority series and stuff like that. But is your view that this is not that kind of cheap bad kind of reasoning where you're getting tricked into accepting something you didn't want to accept?
I don't think so. I mean, yeah, what normally goes on in these small differences arguments is, yeah, come on, there are halfway cases which are neither one nor the other. But here I'm precisely trying to raise difficulties for the halfway cases.
Right.
It's like, yeah, this would be a very natural thing to say, but consciousness gradually fades out. But then I'm actually trying to raise a problem for consciousness gradually
fading out.
If that happens, then you're going to have these cases in the middle where the being is very wrong about its own consciousness.
So another one of your claims, right, is that a life in a virtual reality can be at least as good or maybe even better than a life in a sort of non-digital or non-simulated reality. What's your reasoning there? Why do you say that?
There's a classic challenge to the value of life in virtual reality posed by the philosopher Robert Nozick back in the 1970s with his example of the experience machine. The experience machine was meant to be a kind of virtual world where you got to live a wonderful life. It was all set up in advance, so you'd have wonderful experiences of a happy life. I don't know, maybe you're successful in your career, you've got a wonderful family, everything goes great. But it's all simulated, and it's all pre-programmed in advance. And Nozick said, would you enter the experience machine? Should you enter it? Would you enter? And he said his intuition was very strongly, no, you should not enter the experience machine, at least in part because nothing there is real. And many people have taken this. Many people have been convinced by Nozick that you shouldn't enter the experience machine. And they've taken this to be a critique of virtual reality in general, that virtual world somehow, because things are not real, then we shouldn't enter the experience machine. We shouldn't enter virtual reality. I want to argue that even if Nozick's right about the experience machine, it doesn't really transfer to virtual reality. In my view, the worst thing about the experience machine is that it involves a pre-programmed life where you don't really get to genuine autonomy, where you determine what will happen to you by making choices and so on. In those experience machine, because it's all pre-programmed, I think then you lose that very central source of meaning and value in your life. That doesn't apply to virtual reality, on the other hand. You, even in a standard video game world, you still get to make choices. You get to interact with the world. It's not predetermined what will happen to you. You go into a world even now like Second Life. You can actually live an autonomous life and make choices and so on, and certainly in a full-scale virtual world. It's just not pre-programmed in the way that Nozick's experience machine is. Now, somebody might argue, nevertheless, nothing is real in virtual reality, and therefore life there is lacking in meaning or value. Well, that's where I bring in my earlier arguments, that in fact, inside a virtual world, things are fully real, and therefore, you know, their unreality is no objection to life there being valuable and meaningful, because things inside a virtual world are real. So at this point, I think the metaphysics plays in to the value theory. If someone was inclined to think that, you know, being unreal is greatly undercuts the meaning and value of your life, then I think, well, you know, the metaphysics in favor of virtual reality being genuine reality also counts in favor of it being genuinely valuable.
So Ananda, what's your view on these questions of value and meaningfulness of life in VR?
Yeah, I guess there's a few places where I might push back, I guess. One issue is that there's lots of different cases, right? So you can imagine, just popping in and out of virtual reality, knowing that you're in virtual reality when you're in it. In Nozick's experience machine, he's imagining also that you don't know that you're in the experience machine when you're in it. So you have this, you're sort of deceived in a certain way. I guess one worry one might have is that going into virtual reality for, say, an extended period of time, or you give up the right to leave or something like that, then you might be giving up autonomy over your physical body. So you still have a physical life that you're giving up on to some extent. You're giving up the autonomy to decide over that body. And so that might be a place where the virtual is not quite as good as the non-virtual. And another thing one might worry about, I guess this is also something that was part of the original thought experiment, was that what matters is not just your experiences of things, but the objects that you experience. And though, even if we grant that in a virtual world the objects are real, they're still not identical to the objects that you experience in the physical world. And so at least in some ways, you might think that those experiences are different, and their difference makes a difference to their value. So, for example, you might think that interacting with friends or loved ones indirectly through a virtual reality is somehow less valuable than interacting with them directly in a physical world.
That's interesting. And yeah, I think you're right that there are certainly, if you think about our entering a virtual reality, this would bring along various things that might be at least be undesirable for some people, such as leaving your original body behind or leaving your original loved ones behind. In one version of this,
yeah,
if the people in there are totally new, then, yes. there's going to be a perfect simulation of yeah. of my family in there. It's like, well, I don't want a simulation of my family. I want my actual family. And yeah. It's reasonable to value that. Now, of course, if they actually get to go in there too with you, then it's different. And we could argue about whether the modes of interacting with them are less valuable. But one way to think about this is to not even think about the case where we enter virtual reality, but just think about the hypothesis where everything is a simulation right from the start. Turns out we're in a matrix-like scenario. Some people would say, okay, if that's the case, nothing is real. If that's the case, our life is meaningless or valueless, or at least lacks an enormous amount of meaning and value. I want to say in that scenario, in fact, yeah, we could be in a matrix, and if we are, my life is just about as meaningful as I thought it was before. I still have all these genuine relationships and various projects and so on. And it's about as meaningful as it was in a as it would be in a non-virtual world. Now, this way of setting it up bypasses some of your worries, right? Because there's not going to be a body hanging out in the other world. Everything is simulated, and so on. So, what do you say about that version of the scenario?
Yeah, I mean, I'm less worried about that version. I guess the cases that are more worrying are the back and forth cases. Mm-hmm. I mean, also because, so, you know, certain cases, like if you don't know that you're in the virtual world coming from outside of it, then many of the things that you think you're doing, you're not in fact doing. So you're sort of deceived in this way. I kind of accept the argument that if you're if we are in a simulation, then I actually do think we're still deceived. But the problem is that I think we're deceived in the physical world as well. I mean, I'm sort of like inclined towards skepticism if one accepts certain assumptions as background assumptions. So I think if you accept assumptions about having to rule out possibilities, I think we're in bad shape, whether we're in a physical
we're in trouble
world
either way
or in a simulated world. So then maybe you'd say, yeah, sure, my life has just about as much value because it kind of doesn't have any value.
Oh my gosh,
way.
We're getting nihilistic.
Really
now.
Really cynical.
Okay, it's like we've fallen from Eden a long time ago.
That was a bit of a joke.
I was thinking about making your move against you, which is, it starts to look like, yeah, insofar as there are sources of disvalue, at least the initial ones that you raise seem to come from, not from the virtuality of virtual worlds, but from going back and forth between physical worlds and virtual worlds. So I thought we could use your own move. Say we're actually in the matrix, and then we go to a physical world. It's like, well, then maybe going to the physical world would actually be less valuable than the matrix world that you started in, because you're leaving behind your matrix, I don't know, your matrix body, and leaving behind those matrix people. So it's not now, on this way of doing things, it's not the virtuality which is bad. It's just the moving back and forth which is bad.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm not... part of me also thinks that there's a certain version of the simulation hypothesis where we're not deceived, right? It's just that reality is fundamentally made of bits. And in my view, that's metaphysics, right? That's just a metaphysical claim about the fundamental nature of reality. And I don't feel like that raises the same kinds of issues as worlds in which there's a world sort of outside, a physical world outside the simulation, in which the simulation is sort of embedded, where there are simulators creating this kind of artificial reality. So those, I think, raise slightly different issues. And so I would agree with you that that if we just think of the world as a digital world, then my life has just as much value in the digital world as it does.
It's worlds embedded inside other worlds that start to raise this
Skeptical worries for me. Yeah. Mm. And I think in terms of value, it is virtuality in a sense. It's the indirectness of the relationships that you have in the virtual world that might be destructive of value.
So if we're all fundamentally in a VR situation, then
If we're all lying in vats,
causally connected the way we were, because we're all
if we're all lying in vats, you know, we're not in some sense directly having this conversation right now. You know, I don't know if I should say this on podcast.
Please do.
So you know,
say it. We can cut it out.
Okay, you can cut it out. So they have those. Apparently, I've been told you can get like lips. That you get two pairs of lips, you know, and like your partner, you know, across the world kisses the lips, and it's like attached to you in some way so that you can move the lips that your partner is kissing. and thereby have the experience of kissing your partner, but via this lip, you know. And I kind of think, well, that's kind of what's going on in the VR, okay, without the weird physical
Some people think that's what's actually going on in the physical world, where all these minds controlling these controlling these bodies, which are, and the mind is, all, we're all constructing our experiences of the world, and
but still, you know, if I want to kiss my partner, it's not that way.
Who's to say what future tech might be like?
Yeah. Right, so usually to end the episodes, we ask our guests for some type of philosophical recommendation for our listeners. Dave, do you have something in mind that you want to recommend?
Well, first there are like, you know, TV shows and movies and science fiction novels about these ideas. I guess I especially like the TV show Black Mirror for its illustration of some of these ideas. Some of their episodes, many of their episodes actually explicitly turn on the idea that people are inside simulations and the consequences that this has. And this is a great way to raise many of the philosophical issues. These issues are also pursued in a, remember that I mentioned the paper I wrote for the Matrix website back in the day? A number of philosophical articles on these topics ended up being put together in a book called Philosophers Explore the Matrix that was published now maybe about 20 years ago, but is still, I think, very, very lively and vivid and relevant on these issues. So that's a book that I'd recommend people look out for.
Yeah, and I guess I just recommend Reality Plus. I think it's a great book. Covers pretty much every question in philosophy and in a very engaging way. And yeah, I would recommend it.
Wonderful. Yeah. So Reality Plus is coming out in Swedish soon, right? Virtuella världar, filosofiska problem on Fri Tanke förlag.
They left out the plus.
They did. But check it out anyway.
Yes.
All right. With that, thank you both so much for joining
us. Thanks. It was a pleasure. That's Thanks for a great conversation.
It was great fun.
Filosofisk podcast is produced by the Swedish journal Filosofisk Tidskrift and the publisher Thales. You can reach us through podcast@filosofisktidskrift.se or on the Facebook page Filosofisk Tidskrift. That's all. Thank you.